it's quite amazing what he's written is how he's being pulled one way by the alcohol and another way by everyone else, and what was right and what was wrong. And alcohol is my prominent addiction, though I have lurking in me others waiting to show themselves. To me, dealing with the disease of addiction is like a tug of war between knowing what I should be doing, recognizing the correct and pointless actions on one team, and the disease, cunning, deceiving and baffling. On the other, the disease has a stronger pull, and for a long time, winning many battles. Disease wants to win, and alcoholism will tug relentlessly against my weakened defences.
Hi everybody, welcome back to This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scoville. In this podcast, I speak to some incredible people about mindset, mental health, addiction and recovery. And I share my own journey throughout these conversations. So whether you're on your own path of self-discovery, recovery or transformation, inspired by human stories of mental resilience, or supporting someone who is struggling with addiction, make sure you follow and subscribe to This Is Powerful. There'll be a new episode every Thursday. In these episodes, we will be talking about drug and alcohol misuse, suicide, sexual abuse, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. Welcome back, everybody, to season 5 of This Is Powerful. We're doing something special. We're doing a mini series based on young people, how they are affected by addiction or alcoholism, or their family are affected by addiction and alcoholism. Today, I'm so privileged to welcome the extraordinary Emily and her mother, Lucy. Emily sadly lost her father after a devastating battle with alcoholism when she was just 10 years old. After losing her father, Emily would write letters to him at night before she went to bed. As a result of writing these letters, Emily felt compelled to write to the government and ask for change in how alcohol is sold and advertised, and to ask for support for families of alcoholics. Lucy, Emily's mother, tells us the story of Dan's alcoholism, but we also get a strong sense of an amazing father who loved his children very much and was taken away at the young age of 41 as a result of alcoholism. Lucy, Emily, and I hope this conversation will help raise awareness for those families of alcoholics and to let them know that they're not alone. Welcome, Emily and Lucy, to This Is Powerful. Thank you so much for coming here. It's really lovely to see and very brave of you both to do the work that you're doing to highlight the problems of alcohol and addiction, what it causes on families and society in general. So welcome to This Is Powerful.
Thank you.
I'd love to ask Emily of the letter that you wrote to the first letter, because apparently there might be a second one, but the first letter you wrote to the government, and you got to deliver it to Downing Street with a friend of mine, Callum Best.
Yeah.
What did you compel, would you compel yourself to write the letter?
Yeah. Well, I don't know, because I was writing letters for my dad every, after he passed away, pretty much every day I would just write like a little letter at night or something. And then I just got angry and I just wrote one and put it to the government. But it was just kind of secret, like, yeah. And then she sent it off and then it actually went to the government.
Good for mum. These are important, though, aren't it? Because, you know, when you go through something which is so difficult, it's nice to be able to channel the anger into something positive, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you keep all the letters that you wrote to your dad?
Yeah. I think so. I don't know where they are. They're in my room somewhere.
Rooms are a different conversation, right? Yeah. my daughter's room's interesting, one of them
so
anyway.
Is mine.
Yeah, I have to climb over things to get into the room.
There's bits of paper everywhere, isn't there?
Well, you have really good handwriting, because I just read something else. And were you happy with the letter that you got back from the government, or do you think there should be more things done?
I don't know. They haven't done anything yet. I just hope they will. But it was all right.
Okay. And Lucy, but, I'd love to know a little bit about you more, and for our guests to know, because a lot of people unfortunately have similar journeys. Mm. How was your upbringing, and where are you from?
So my
to put you on the spot,
was complicated, I guess. It's the only way I can describe that. My mum and dad worked a lot, so I was childminded a lot. Some of those occasions weren't very good. And then when I was 11, my granddad died of a heart attack suddenly, and it kind of disrupted the whole family. But I was then, my grandma had a lot to do with me, so she kind of raised me in a way. So I went and stayed there a lot. My mum and dad divorced at the same time. I lived with my grandma for a bit, and my uncle was alcoholic and he lived next door, and he was like a brother to me. I was definitely not much older, but and he had children that were younger, so I used to look after them. And then we'd moved a few times. I was just very close to my grandma, and there was a lot of drinking, but I didn't really think it was an issue. I never thought alcohol was a problem, because it was just normal. People drank. My uncle was out. We knew my uncle was alcoholic, so that was just, well, he said he is, so that's okay. So it's we all carried on.
It's funny in British society, isn't it? Because we had that in our family too.
Yeah.
And my grandfather was a drinker, and at Christmas, everyone would buy him a scotch.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a totally normal thing to do, which I found was not really normal as a young person.
Yeah, we used to drink sherry. My grandma loved sherry, so we'd sit in the evening and all have a sherry.
Yeah.
I was quite young. I like sherry.
It's normal, isn't it, in our society, which I think is quite an important thing to highlight.
Yeah, that was normal. Then my uncle's son died suddenly in a car accident, and that threw everything way out. And then that was an excuse almost, that my uncle can drink more. It doesn't matter because he'd lost his son. So then I met Dan at that point. So
how old
probably
you
a
when
month,
you met
so 25. I met him a month after he had died. And again, I didn't see alcohol as a problem, but he was actually alcoholic then. So
where did you guys meet?
In the theatre in we were in London. He was one of the main parts in this stage show doing Boogie Nights, and I was singing backstage.
Was you?
And he came backstage, and I liked him a lot. And all the girls liked him. He was so funny, and he was doing stand-up comedy in the evenings, and then he'd obviously doing all the shows, and he was an actor, and he was just so full of life, everybody. And then we'd all go out, and he'd get bought a lot of drinks because that's what people did after the shows.
Mm.
And so
which is quite normal in the theatre,
right?
Yeah,
very normal, yeah. Yeah, it was very normal. And the only thing I found a bit difficult was I didn't know if he liked me or if he liked all the other girls.
That's a problem, I guess, of being so popular.
And I wanted to meet up with him, and I was surprised when he said to me, "Oh, could we meet up? And do you want to come over?" I said, "Yeah."
Brilliant! So you want him over.
Yeah.
So you both were in the performing arts.
Yeah, we were. And he was. He always, because he loved acting. That's what he wanted to do.
Yeah.
But then we were, after that show, he then did stand-up comedy for a bit longer.
Was that in London also?
Yeah, and he was funny. He was brilliant, and he was so full of life. And I didn't really realise there was an issue with the alcohol straight away, but it gradually, within, I would say, it only took about 2 weeks before I then went, he's got a problem with alcohol, I think. But, and so we talked about it a bit. He said, no, that it's fine. I know I can just cut down, I'll just give up, it's fine. But he was drinking every day, and I noticed that. And said, hmm.
Was that a correlation with the relative?
Yeah,
as well?
I suppose I just thought, I don't know. Is that normal? Is that? I didn't really know what alcohol meant. I didn't know what it meant to be an alcoholic.
It's so hard to define, isn't it? Because when in my own family, when you're used to having that amount of drinking around, it's a normal thing, a normal part of society. Mm. Even in conversation, oh, should we go and have a half, or should we this? And it just becomes normalised, doesn't it? And I think for me, especially at work, when someone's functioning, they're so talented, the sums don't add up, does it? You can't be like this if you have a problem.
Yeah.
So maybe the problem's not there, which I think is important to talk about.
There was some other issues, but I didn't quite realise that on the stage, on one of the nights, he was absolutely drunk. And I hadn't noticed. I think people didn't notice unless they knew that he'd been drinking. So, and the stage manager did realise and near enough kicked him out, but I didn't know why, because I wasn't a part of that conversation.
Yeah.
And so we left the theatre and we moved. He was living in a flat that was owned by his auntie, but I didn't realise he wasn't paying any of the bills to this flat. He was literally just living there. Mm. And eventually his auntie kicked him out. But again, he hid so much from me at that point. And then he wanted to move in with his mum. He moved into his mum's. He said, I can't be here. I don't want to be at my mum's house. So he moved. He then came into my car. He said, I've got nowhere to live. And yeah, there's a lot of stuff happened in between. But me and him ended up living with my grandma in my grandma's house.
And where was that?
Which was in Leyston, which is it's quite a long way in Suffolk, on the coast, well away from anywhere. So, and my family owned a holiday park, so we both started working in the holiday park instead. And yeah, but he was drinking then.
As entertaining, or?
We were doing some, it was mostly just running people coming in, and we were doing changeovers and bookings and anything that needed doing, really. So not a lot of entertaining. We did a bit. We'd basically go to London and do various things, but not that often. And then I got pregnant with Isaac. And the family, they're like, well, we've got to, Dan said, I've just got to do something. I've got to get a proper job. So he decided to go into teaching.
Oh, okay.
Because he said, right, I want to be a drama teacher. I'll go and do that. So
Which is responsible, I think, because when children come along, you kind of have a shake up, don't you? Like, okay, what are we doing now? You said that you were slightly unsure about his drinking early on.
Yeah.
But was there something that changed it to for you to notice that it was worse?
It wasn't that I noticed it in him. I found three bottles of empty vodka in a bag that he had left open in the room, and I thought, why is there empty bottles of vodka? Mm. And that's when I kind of thought, has he drank all of those? And he was being very just not normal in some ways. He went in the bathroom and he didn't come out the bathroom, and I was like, what is going on?
Yeah.
And he lied to me a lot, and I didn't realise. When I did realise, I left him, actually. I went, right, I've had enough. And that wasn't long into the relationship.
Yeah.
I left, and I actually sent him a text, said, I know what's going on. I know that you've been drinking. I know, like, there was texts from other girls. There was all sorts going on. So I just said, no, I'm not going to be a part of this. And I went back to my family and I said that everything that happened, what I'd found out, I also found out he told me he was working and he wasn't. It was so many things.
Yeah.
And then my family were quite angry. And then a few weeks later, he asked me to meet up just to talk as friends, nothing else. I said, yeah, okay. Because I still liked him. So I went and met up with him. And he said, I'm so sorry, it's not like that. I'll sort my life out. It's not. So he said he'd do all the things. And then he even came over to my family and apologised to my mum and my grandma, and stood in the kitchen, said, I'm sorting myself out. It's not what it seems.
It's a very stoic thing to do at the time.
So, yeah, and then went from there, really. I gave him a second chance, I suppose. Mm. That's what I saw it as, but actually, if it was now, I wouldn't have had... so much stronger now, I wouldn't... Yeah.
It's very hard though, isn't it, when you love someone and like I said, you see all the talent and the kind side and the stoic side of people. And I think for me personally, having addiction and alcoholism is like having a sort of corrosive thread that you can't see inside the person that starts to take everything away. And even we had a really good neuropsychopharmacologist on there who said that your brain gets hijacked, basically.
Yeah.
And it's weird because you try and do nice things and you're trying to be a good person, but this keeps pulling you back and seems to be stronger, right?
Yeah.
And it's more than frustrating because it's... I did have a partner who was alcoholic as well once, and she did the same thing with the bath. She used to bath 3 times a day, and I'm like, you can only bath once is enough, isn't it? But she was secretly drinking in there. And I thought I was very smart and I would have sussed it out. And it took me about 8 months to work out something wasn't right, because I started to question myself.
Yeah.
Is there something right? Doesn't add up, but it's not too bad, so I'm not quite sure.
Yeah. What are they doing in there?
Yeah.
He used to lay in the bath hours and obviously just filling up the drink and laying in the bath. So
yeah.
Didn't really... Yeah,
it's a difficult...
But
it's,
he says that from what he's written in his... because he wrote a book, basically, that I need to release. But he has, in that book, he said, about that pull with addiction, and I'll have to find it in a minute and read it to you, because it's quite amazing what he's written is how he felt. He was so torn between everything, and he was being pulled one way by the alcohol and another way by everyone else, and... What was right and what was wrong. And
wow, that's amazing. And when did he write this?
He wrote this in 2016.
Right.
So he's talking about when he was 14 years old. He's talked about his childhood and, yeah. Skipping forward to 14 years old, the experiments with minor legal scale of drinking. On the way to youth club, I lied my ass off to my parents every Friday night, telling them that me and three other boys were walking up to the high school disco. That was true, but then we were going to get a lift home at about 9:30 by one of their dads. This was bullshit. We walked through Basildon town centre, which in hindsight was a dangerous place for such a scrawny young lad with such a heavy drinking atmosphere on a Friday night in town. Unless I've blocked this out too, we didn't witness fights or never felt threatened, but there was always an air of edginess on the journey home. It was during these walks that I had my first recollections of trying alcohol, or at least a couple of times with some of the boys who stole a couple of cans of small spirits. And we all felt very grown up. It had no effect on us, and it was all about bravado of getting pissed and with none of the chemical buzz.
He's a very good writer, isn't he?
It's amazing. I find the bit... that he said about his maybe this one, I don't know. Alcohol is my prominent addiction, though I have lurking in me others waiting to show themselves. Control, obsessive compulsive disorder, women have all appeared in my past with or without alcohol as addiction that left unchecked could equally ruin my life. To me, dealing with the disease of addiction is like a tug of war between knowing what I should be doing, recognizing the correct and pointless actions on one team, and the disease, cunning, deceiving and baffling. On the other, the disease has a stronger pull, and for a long time winning many battles. Disease wants to win, and alcoholism will tug relentlessly against my weakened defenses.
Wow. That's so eloquent.
Yeah.
It's really, he really knows himself, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that's really important to hear, because a lot of people who have addiction won't be able to say that so clearly. But that's really what happens.
Yep. My obsessions are often not instantly recognisable to me. Rather, they sneak up, grab me unaware, and progressively show themselves. Often seen as obsessions by other people, I notice myself the only person I can recognise with any of my addiction or relapse, specifically back into drinking, is how gradual the obsession starts, often before I even act on it. They say you've already planned your next relapse long before you pick up the next drug or drink. This applies to me. I often go through period of unrest, feeling unsettled and unfulfilled. The disease, my moods become erratic until I give in to the obsession.
That is so well written. That's so
that's amazing.
But it's true, isn't it? It's like you're it's incredible, because then saying, telling about his powerlessness, isn't he, over the addiction and how strong it is.
And then all bets are off. The obsession consumes my time and the energy and often my money, and my behaviour will adjust themselves to obtain whatever it is I'm craving. Deceitfulness, lying, stealing, manipulating, acting in ways that go against my morals and values in society, or all out of obsession.
When did Daniel ask for help first?
It was, I think, when Isaac was quite young. He must have been about 2-ish, so I think we just had Emily, and he said, he then admitted, he said, I need to get some help, I can't, because what he was doing is going to work, because at that point he was then teaching, and he's coming home, and then he would drink wine or beer, and he would drink until he fell asleep on the sofa, and then I'd just be doing everything with the children and trying to keep everything normal as I could. But it actually happened when I decided that I wasn't going to start, because I was pouring alcohol down the sink to stop him drinking it. I was trying everything I could to stop him drinking. And then I, for some reason, just went, no, I need to stand back and let him fall, almost go, right, we'll see what happens. So I stepped back. And I didn't pour it away. I just let him get on with it. And it was then that he then realised he had a problem, or admitted he had a problem. And then he was crying and saying, I need to sort this out. So we made a doctor's appointment, and he went, I didn't go with him, but he went to the doctor and they said, you're not bad enough. They said, what are you drinking? And he said, obviously wine, beer, mostly wine. And they said, and he was working, so you're functioning alcoholic. You're like, and so they said, well, he said, can't you send me to rehab? Can you help me? And they said, no, because we only send one person a year to rehab. They said, you could try Turning Point, I guess, or just try and cut down gradually yourself. Like, and then that was
impossible.
It. That was literally, he came back and he said, well, apparently I'm not bad enough. And I said, how bad do you have to be? And I didn't know what bad enough meant anyway.
And did he sort any other help after that? Because that's a big blow, isn't it? And it's hard because doctors don't get taught enough at all about alcoholism or addiction, because if someone is working, or if their compass mentors can have a conversation, they think that they're not bad enough, which is really horrible, because behind the scenes, life's...
He said, do I have to like crawl in there and pretend that I can't even hold a conversation for them to send me? So it was like, he was so upset, and he said, it's so unfair. And he kind of, I think he went downhill a bit then. I think we also, because of that conversation, we had social services came in just to check everything at home. So,
which is intrusive, because you're working hard as a mum, parent, and a partner, right, to keep everything going.
They didn't stay very long, because we wouldn't. No, I don't know. No, everything's fine. Just leave. And they kind of put everything on the parent that's not drinking anyway. It was never about him.
Yeah.
It was all to see if I was doing okay, if I was raising them okay, and whereas I think if they came in and said, right, we'll sort the alcoholic out, that would be way better than trying to put everything on to...
There lies the problem, I guess.
Yeah.
Oh, bless you. Yeah. Emily, when did you don't mind me asking, notice that your dad wasn't well?
Oh, God. How old was I, like 8 or 9, maybe? Actually, why would I ask? I don't know. Yeah, it might have been before that. I was quite young, though, and I just was, like, kind of thought it was normal until I met other people's dads, and I was like, wait, no, that's not normal at all.
I'd say about 4 or 5-ish.
Yeah.
Because we used to do books, so I didn't keep it a secret from them. That was one thing I said to...
Right.
I researched a lot about how to help children who were their parents.
Yeah.
So we went through these books, didn't we? But yeah. She didn't remember that. Isaac remembers, but Emily
wouldn't. It's so generous of you, because it's a lot of effort to do that, isn't it?
Mm.
And that's the thing that probably you don't remember, but it was probably a lot of help early on from mum, right?
Yeah.
Were you... how did that affect you at school? Because addiction, alcoholism affects the whole family and the whole environment around, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Did that affect you at school?
I'd say so, yeah. Because, like, I had, like, my friends and stuff, which were definitely helpful. But I couldn't really talk to them about it because they wouldn't understand, and the school was kind of like, just don't bring it up. It makes people uncomfortable, and just, yeah, don't tell anyone about that. That was at my, what was that, first primary school?
First primary school.
And then I went to a different one. And that one's much better. I could talk about it more.
It's hard, isn't it? If you're, I'm not sure how that schools can say that you can't talk about something, because that's a big thing, isn't it?
Mm.
Did that make you kind of retract a bit?
Yeah, well, when I got to my second school, I didn't really talk about it at all, because I thought, no one's going to want to hear, no one wants to know about what's going on in my life. They've got their own life.
It's, yeah.
Not their problem.
Did that make you guys closer, though, do you think? Because you work as a team, in essence.
Yeah, we could talk about it within the house, but, there was quite a few times where they said, don't talk about it with the friends, because... they just don't understand, or it's too big for them. Most children haven't heard, like, they don't know what alcoholic is. And there was incidences, obviously we had a few at home, where then Emily would go to school and tell her friends what happened with Daddy. Obviously we had a lot of ambulances and a lot of he had seizures and things, so family explained to her friends, because it was traumatic, like, this has happened, and they'd go and tell their parents, and then there was a lot of judgment, let's put it that way. A lot,
yeah. And there is in society, unfortunately, isn't there? And it's difficult, because again, you're not heard, and it's so impactful and everything, isn't it, on sleep and daily life and the anxiety of worrying, I guess. Did you get to a point where you didn't worry, Lucy, in the sense that it became a pattern in the life, and you didn't feel like it was an emergency?
Yeah, well, things that would have been shocking didn't shock me. Yeah. And so when I was telling people what happened, they were like, oh my God, how did you deal with that? And I was thinking, it's not that big a deal. But looking back, actually, it was quite a lot of it was traumatic.
Yeah.
And there was like, different occasions. Dan had psychosis at one point, and he was really ill. But I thought, I've got to get the children out of the house and me. And I was walking on eggshells, literally trying to get away from the situation. And then we called an ambulance, and he went to hospital. But Dan came out with a big, massive knife, because he said he was going to kill himself. And I'm trying to get the children out of the house. And if you're telling anybody that, like, what are you doing in that situation in the first place?
Yeah.
And so it's all, then the blame all goes on to me quite a lot. And looking back, there were things I thought I should have acted sooner. I shouldn't have, maybe I should have left. There was quite a few things I thought.
It's so easy to say things in hindsight, though, because when you're living something, this is just my experience anyway, you always try to protect everyone around you and look after them. Yeah. And there's always the hope that maybe one day, or maybe something will change, right? So it's easy to look a situation from the outside with judgment when you have absolutely no idea of what it's like to be in it.
Yeah. And the other one, that last situation, I just went, right, I do have to get Dan out of the house. He cannot live with us in this state. So I did put him into, he went into like a dry house. I managed to get some help because I didn't want to kick him out on the street. And I still loved him and wanted him to be okay. And there was always that, he's going to get better. He's going to be okay.
Mm.
So, a couple of times.
And what happened then? So you got him into a dry house and did he stay there for a while?
He stayed there for a bit. He didn't really get better. We had social services and everything involved at that point, which was horrendous because they just were, you're not doing this, you need to, he's not allowed to see the children unsupervised, obviously, but you have to meet him in the park, places like that. They told him the same, you're not allowed to drink, then you can see your children.
Mm.
They were kind of playing us off against each other, I found that was quite bad. And then we met at the park and with the children, and I don't think how old Dan, he might have been four maybe, how is it? But at this point, we'd gone in and we'd gone to the park, he hadn't drank, he'd done everything social service, he was like, right, okay, I'm not allowed to drink, I'll go and see the children. So he asked me to go meet up in a public place with everyone else. And then he had the first fit that he ever had. And that was, he went to play on he said, let's go and sit. We sat on this seesaw thing and then he just flew backwards and hit the slide and was foaming out the mouth. He was then unconscious.
Yeah.
And everything was witnessed by the children because he'd done what they said and stopped drinking suddenly.
Yeah, which is so dangerous.
I was terrified because I'd never seen anything like it. And I just couldn't even ring the ambulance. I was like shaking. I was trying to sort out, people around me sorted out, but I did not have a clue that that could even happen because I hadn't looked into that kind of thing. I didn't.
Yeah, it's really, it's confusing for people, but it's very, very dangerous for someone to stop drinking immediately because of that, and they can die from that.
Yeah.
So detox is really important, isn't it? Weaning yourself off, which is impossible.
I think that was the first time we went into hospital. He broke his hip when he fell. So he shattered all the way down to his knee almost. So they put him on morphine and sent him out. He couldn't go back to the dry house because he couldn't get up the stairs. He couldn't stay there. And so he moved in with me and the children again. And and I looked after him. But he got worse and worse because he couldn't then walk or...
Mm.
And eventually I'd... 6 weeks later, I'd call an ambulance and beg them to take him back to hospital to replace his hip. And they did. They said, on the condition you do not drink ever again, we'll replace your hip. And that was one of the surgeons said that. So he said, I'll never drink, I won't drink again, because he obviously didn't want to drink again. It was like...
And I bet he meant it at the time.
And it was on morphine, so he didn't. And he had his hip replaced. I went in and the day after, and he was shaking, violently shaking in the bed. And I said, what's wrong with him? And he's anxious. It's inbuilt anxiety. And that's why he's shaking, even though he's not conscious. And I was like, how is that possible? And that's when I thought, this is what he's trying to cover up with the alcohol all the time. And and then from there, he ended up in rehab after that. That's when I was like, oh, that's what bad enough means. Right, got it. So, yeah.
Then where did he go to rehab?
To Portsmouth.
Okay.
And he was there for 3 months over Christmas. And, dear, that was 2016, end of 2016, kind of.
Was there a change whilst he was in rehab?
Yeah, massive change in him. Because I'd got to the point where I was, I can't do this anymore. I can't be in a relationship with you if you're not going to sort things out. So, and his personality, everything changed because it's like he suddenly realised. That's when he started writing what he was writing. He's like, I'm going to write a book. And he started writing then.
Oh, that makes sense.
Because he then had lots of, I suppose, counselling, which he'd never had. He'd never had the help before. And he was starting to know who he was and why. So, yeah, he did well then. And we moved while he was there, and we moved into house in the middle of nowhere. It's amazing, and I just said, right, I'm starting again, and if he comes out and he can move back in with us. Mm. So that's what we did, and it was good.
Was that a nice time for you, Emily,
yeah,
as well?
We visited him in Portsmouth. I think it was hard for him being away from us at Christmas, and yeah. But he definitely got a lot better. He should have stayed in another 3 months afterwards. That was the only thing. He came out and they put him in a dry house again into somewhere temporary, not too far from us, but and that was meant to be with support from Turning Point, but nobody followed up.
Oh, really?
So it was, and it then was probably the worst place, thing that right? could have happened in a way.
Yeah.
He came out and he was put in this house, and not only that, the house he was in, he was put in with one of his ex-students who'd finished, was also in recovery, but he was put straight into this house, and he started drinking within 3 days of being back.
Wow.
And although he started drinking again, he wasn't the same person. And then he went through a while of, I think he spent a couple of months drinking, but then he stopped again. And it was like he could kind of stop and start almost.
Yeah.
16, 17, 18. Then we ended up 2020 lockdown.
How was that? Because lockdowns either affected people in a positive way or in a negative way. How was that for you guys?
He stopped drinking while everyone else started drinking. he stopped.
Like to do things differently then.
That was so weird.
It's good to be different sometimes. Yeah. How long for?
Nearly the whole of lockdown. That was
really?
Quite 2022.
Wow.
No, 2020, he was really, he did well. He started teaching the children because he became their teacher.
Wow.
And,
I bet that was a lovely period,
that.
Wasn't it?
It was fun.
Was it strange having dad as a teacher?
Yeah. It was so weird. Because he used to get like the online work, because obviously you have the online school like on the laptop or whatever. And he had like the English and maths and stuff, and he would just teach us all. And then in the lounge, he had like a little mat, like just a floor mat or whatever. And he was like, right, sit on the mat for your assembly.
Did he?
And that would be our assembly room. And he'd put like, what did he do? Signs on the doors sometimes? Yeah. Like your English lesson and stuff.
Oh, that's
like
brilliant.
That. Oh, that was actually so fun.
So you probably had better schooling than most.
Yeah.
Oh, how wonderful.
Awesome. And then snacks for lunch.
Oh, yeah. And then he had like the little snack pot. So he had a pot with like either like a few sweets, a banana, some crisps, and then a drink you can choose. That was so fun.
Like a nice little packed lunch, basically.
Yeah.
He took you out on walks, and he went round the around the village and took walkie-talkies.
Oh my god, no. That was so fun, because we had like two walkie-talkies. I think we got them, where do we get them from? I don't know, it might have been a present or something. But like we had these two walkie-talkies. Was it two or three?
Four. We had four walkie-talkies.
Oh yeah, we had four, like a pack of four. We would take three and we would just go down like around the fields, and then we'd all have our walkie-talkies on. So me and Isaac would run away as far as we could and then be like, hello.
Oh, that's brilliant.
I still have a picture of like all of us holding them like, hello.
Oh, how much fun was that?
That was so fun.
Oh, lovely. That's brilliant. Is it nice? And are you okay looking back at nice memories like that?
Yeah, I like it.
Oh, it's lovely.
Yeah, Daddy, he was good. He was really, he definitely loved Isaac and Amelie. So close, in mostly to Amelie. He was very close. He was quite hard on Isaac, I would say. Maybe, I don't know whether.
That's probably a man and boy thing.
Yeah.
Where you want to try and make him strong. And
he was always a bit more, and but. He would put say goodnight, and then he would shout to Emily, hey, love you.
Oh. Yeah, we used to do like this like playful argument thing where we'd be like, love you more than jelly beans, because he like he loved jelly beans. And then we'd be like, love you to the moon and back, and then like the stars. And then we would just say loads of random things like, I love you more than a table or something like that. And we just kept saying random stuff.
I do that with my oldest. That's what we do. We go from railway lines to countries.
Yeah, exactly. We go everywhere.
To like giraffe necks. Yeah. It gets my wife's like, have you finished yet?
Go to bed.
I love that because it's such a creative, like,
yeah,
fun,
so fun.
Fun
yeah.
process, isn't it? When the inevitable happened, did you ask for help for you guys as well outside?
Well, towards the end of lockdown, Dan started drinking, but it was more so Dan was binge drinking rather than drinking consistently.
Yeah.
And I think that clearly was worse than drinking consistently, because he'd be fine and then suddenly he would just, like, it just, Amazon started doing online deliveries, and so he would order it to the house, and it was so disappointing when he relapsed. I was just heartbroken, and I was like, I can't believe we've just gone through all of this and it's good. So it was such a loss at that point. I thought, I've lost him. And there's nothing I can do to get him back. And I kind of gave up in a way, because I was just so, I was struggling as it was.
Well, it's heartbreaking, literally.
And yeah, and he'd gone from being this amazing dad to then he's asleep all the time. So I think the children then were missing him. I was missing him and had no adult conversation.
Yeah.
And sat like downstairs just on my own because he was upstairs, or we'd go out a lot. I'd take the children out all the time, and then he was in hospital every single month. I had to call the ambulance, so he was back in hospital, then he was back out, then he was back in again, and then he and I could see he was just getting worse, and then his liver started getting. They kept saying, he's got liver damage, and then somebody else said, no, he hasn't. So I had so much conflicting stuff from the doctors. I was like, well, is he, what's going on? He had diagnosed with tons of different things, they said. And then he got really, really bad in, at the end, so 2021, eventually he said in 2022, they're not going to hospital anymore. I'm done with hospitals. I don't ever want to go back there. So he refused to go for the next, like, few months, and then that's when he started really deteriorating, because then he couldn't walk anymore. So I was washing him. He had stopped drinking because he couldn't physically. He could barely drink anything at that point. So if he had a shot of vodka, although it would kind of stabilize him a bit, he couldn't tolerate it, so he would throw it up. So as soon as he even touched alcohol, he was being sick. So there was a lot of times where he was just being sick downstairs, laying on the sofa all the time. And it got to his birthday, which was January 2022, and I thought, he's made it to 41, okay. And he just looked so ill, and I thought, he's not, I don't know if he's got long. And that was when Isaac was saying to me, Isaac had said, how long's daddy got left? And I said, I don't know. I said, just enjoy the time you've got with him, because we literally don't know, nothing. So, but the worse he got, I was asking for help from adult social care, because I was trying to help him wash, dress and everything. He really couldn't do anything, should have been in hospital, but he was refusing to go, I couldn't. And he got stuck in the bath. He was like, I had to call the ambulance. They came out, they got him out of the bath, but he refused to go in. And they said, well, you're likely to fall and bleed to death, so if you don't go in. But he still said, no, I'm not going. Then adult social care were meant to come in. They hadn't. I needed somewhere for him to be that was like a disabled accommodation. I was trying desperately to get him into somewhere so that he could get looked after. I didn't know he could have gone into a hospice, but I wasn't told that till after he died. So we then found a disabled flat type. So it was ground floor, and then social services came in and they raised all the furniture and made it so that he could get in and out of the bedroom. So I then was between the two houses trying to help him again, but I still didn't have any actual help coming to help me sort him out. So I was taking them to school, driving over to him, which, because the closest place was 40 minutes, so it was literally, I was driving 40 minutes there, 40 minutes back, and back again at least 2-3 times a day.
Bless you.
Trying to look after him. And then I was begging for a doctor's appointment. Finally, adult social care said, we'll come in on the 19th, I think it was, they said, of September. And I said, so I was waiting for that date. Then I asked the doctors to see him. And they said, we can't see him till the 16th. This was 2 weeks before, I think it was. And they said, oh, we can't see him for another 2 weeks because we're too busy. And I said, can you come to the house? They said, no. Bring him in on the 16th of August. So it was Isaac's birthday on the 9th of August. So I took Isaac over there for the very last time on the 9th because he'd gone bright yellow at that point. And I thought, he hasn't got long. So then eventually on the 16th, I could not wait for that day to come because he said, I tell you what, I will go to the doctor, but I won't go to the hospital. Got him to the doctors and they said, they just took one look at him, did observations. They said, you've got to go to hospital because you've got decompensated liver failure is what we think it is. So I was like, all right, okay, well, didn't Google it, thought better not. So I just, they said, we'll call an ambulance. Called an ambulance. They said, we'll be 4 hours. So Dan, they said, if you wait here, the surgery will be shut by the time the ambulance comes. You'd be better off just driving him in. And he was like, I'm not going to hospital. And so then I sat with him, the doctor sat with him, and he started crying. I said, you've got to go to hospital because if we come into your house, then we find you, what if we find you dead in there? Do you want your children to find you? And at that point he cried and he said, no. He said, you're right, I'll go into hospital. So I was like, so I got him in the car, we didn't speak, and we literally drove fast to get, I was like, one hospital was one way, one hospital. I was thinking, which hospital to go to? I got to that crossroad of like, right, okay. So we went to a hospital. He usually went to Ipswich, but I took him to Bury instead for the first time. And we drove there, got there, and I had to get a wheelchair from the car park and push him up this massive hill. And I thought, this is the last time I'll do this. But, oh, it was horrible. And he just looked so ill. And we got in and there were queue outside. A&E was massive, but the doctor had written a letter, took that to but while we were waiting in the queue to be seen, this nurse came over, she said, follow me, being that colour gets you fast tracked.
Right.
So
yeah,
she took us straight into recess, I think it was, and it was silent, and I was thinking, oh, it's so quiet. And they put a heart monitor on, which was being monitored by somewhere else, so it was still quiet. And then he was crying. I said, I'll stay with you, don't worry, I'm gonna stay here, I'm not gonna leave you, I'll be here.
And were the kids at home at that point?
Yeah, they were with my mum at that point, I think. So they then said, you need to go on a heart ward. His heart was not, it was failing, so he had to get onto, so they put him on a cardiac ward, and they stabilised him and said, we'll keep him here. And then they said, we need to move him to the gastro ward a week later. So he was there for a week. Then a week later, but his colour was still going darker yellow. And it wasn't really, they said, like, everything's improving except this one bit, the liver. And but they said there's something wrong with his, in his stomach, possibly stomach cancer. He was coming up with different levels of different things. PSA levels really high. And they said, we need to sort this out, so we're moving to a gastro ward so we can investigate further. But while he was on there, he was too ill to have any checks. So then he got C. diff and he started getting other hospital illnesses. And they moved him into a side room on his own, and he couldn't do anything for himself. So he could use his phone. He was texting me and ringing me a lot. Like through the night, I was up like four in the morning. He'd ring me because he didn't know whether it was night or day. Mm. And then he started to get better, so I thought, oh, maybe he's going to be okay. And I wasn't really being told everything. I was told, because I went to visit him, they said, oh, you can't visit, it's not visiting hours yet. And so again, I was, that was 2 o'clock in the afternoon, was visiting hours, and I didn't. So I assumed because they were saying I couldn't go in, he's actually doing better. But then we'd gone on the weekend, me and his mum had gone to see him, and he was a bit different. And he started ordering tons off Amazon to come to our house. So we started getting these packages arriving through the post to our house. It was really bad. And then we got a puppy in the middle of it all. I don't know what we're doing.
That's probably a nice little thing to have, actually.
There you go. If children have a puppy, it'll make you feel better.
Yeah. to focus on. I hope you still have the puppy now.
Yeah, we do.
Three. So, and then he sent us these blankets, and they were really colourful.
Yeah, I remember them.
All right.
Do you have them?
Thanks for the blanket. He said, it's a unicorn, not blanket. And I was like, are you right?
Okay.
And then, then he sent me a pot plant on the Sunday. It's really weird, because so I got this plant at the door with a card saying, I know it's hard, but I love you. And and then I said I couldn't go on the Monday because I'd spent every day up there. I said I'll come on Tuesday because I've got to sort the children out. So I didn't go on the Monday, and I didn't hear anything from him. And I rang the hospital. I said, is there anything going on? I haven't heard from him. And I thought maybe he just can't reach his phone. He can't get out of bed, so he can't get to anything. And they said, oh no, all his obs are fine. He's up. He's dressed. He's eaten. So I thought, okay, he's just not able to get to the phone. They said, oh, pretty much. Oh, don't worry, we're taking care of him. He's done this to himself. You don't have to do anything. Like, he would like that. Mm. And I thought, okay. But something was telling me to go up. I should have gone up. But I didn't go up. I waited. And the next day, I didn't sleep all night. I was awake all night that night. And then the next day, we were going out with a friend not far from the hospital to go to this horse play.
Who's that?
Horse riding for the first time ever.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
So I dropped her off at her friend's, and I was 5 minutes from the hospital, and they rang me and said, can you get to the hospital now and come straight to critical care? And so I was like, I didn't know what happened at that point. And I got there, and I was like, where's critical care? And they kind of directed me, and I was shaky. I rang my mum. I was, can you come here? And they said, they put me in this side room, and I thought, they said, we'll come, a doctor will come and talk to you in a minute. And so I thought, he's died, and they're going to tell me he's dead. And I was thinking, what's happened? So they said, then they came and spoke to me and said, he deteriorated overnight, and we've had to ventilate him this morning. So we'll take you in to see him, but he is with all the tubes and everything. He's quite bad. Mm-hmm. So they went. I went in. I was so shocked by everything I saw in there. I was like, oh, wow, so much. They said he should be okay. We're just giving him. He couldn't breathe, so we're giving him that chance to give his body a rest, so that we can breathe for him, and then he should start getting better. But so I didn't really know what to expect from that point. Mum, family came up and joined me, and then they said he should be okay. We're going to wake him up in 2 days' time. So okay, so we were just up there, just sitting, waiting, really. And then that's the day that they came to wake him up. I went in, and they said we tried to wake him up, and he had a fit while on the ventilator, and unfortunately set all his care right back to the very beginning. And he's so unstable. And he bit through the breathing tube. We had to resuscitate him twice. Right. So we don't. Also, we think he might be brain damaged from having the fit. We don't know if he's gonna be okay to come off the ventilator. We'll see how he does in the next 24 hours. And they said, but there's lots of stuff that could go wrong now. If he gets an infection, if he get his kidneys could fail, and all sorts of things like that. So, okay. Then they told me all the percentages of, like, oh, if he comes off the ventilator, it's like a 20% chance he could come off the ventilator, 10% chance of going downstairs into the hospital, 5% chance this, and 1% chance he could leave the hospital, but he'd be in a care home. There were so many things. Yeah. I was like, okay. And I took that tiny percent chance thinking that'll be fine. He's not going to. So we then went up to I think it was the next day I went up, and a few days later they said, and I looked at the bag that has the where the kidneys go into, and it turned red, and I said, he's in kidney failure, isn't he? And the nurse just looked, she went, mm-hmm. Yeah. So I knew then, that's it, there's nothing. So I said, what happens now? And they said, we're going to have to make the choice to turn off the ventilator. So if you can, we just need to, we'll do it really controlled and really well and get the whole family up. And we talked about taking the children up. Do we take them up? Do we not? I decided not to in the end. We went through all of the, I think I did talk them through, had the book which explained what it looked like, but we didn't. Then we went up to turn the ventilator off 2 days after that, and they we went to turn it off, and they said there's been a change in circumstances. I was like, what the heck, how can there be? And they said he's an organ donor, and we found that he's asked, while he was in hospital, he signed the paperwork 3 times asking if he dies could he donate the. So they said, we've got 24 hours to find a match, and then he's got to die within a 4-hour time frame after that. And that was all so surreal. And they said, we could ring you at any time to get you to come up here, and you'll have an hour to say goodbye. Wow. So I had my phone like on me. I was waiting for it to ring the whole time, and did not sleep for those. I was awake the whole time waiting for that phone call. And they rang at 6 a.m. and I jumped out my skin when my phone rang. Okay. And they answered it, and they said, we found 3 matches. They're all on their way to hospital.
Wow.
1 for his heart and 2 for his kidneys, because they put him on dialysis to re-sort his kidneys out.
Yeah.
And although for him, they couldn't save him, they said, we can do it for somebody else. And so they did that, and we rushed to the hospital, and I couldn't drive or anything. I'd driven everything up to that point. I couldn't do anything then.
Exhausted.
Yeah, I got a friend drove me up there, and then we had an hour to say goodbye. And then they do a legacy walk where you walk through the corridor with, so they wheel, they said even wheeling him through the corridor, he could like die any minute. So we really got to be careful and trying it. And he'd start, because they have to come off the, some of the medicine things. So they said, he can probably still hear you, but you can't, or she... Yeah, so, and he started to shake, and I was like, oh no, it's gonna fit. And then he's, so I put my hand on his forehead, and I said, it's okay, I'm here. You're going for an operation, and I'm right next to you. And don't, and he seemed to calm.
Yeah.
And then he was fine. I said, I'm not gonna leave you, I'm still here. So holding his hand, and then they took the tube out, and then they, played Amazed by You, Lone Star, on the way through, and he took his last breath at the end of the song.
Wow.
And it was just, and then he's like, go, because we had to leave the room as soon as he died, so they, and all the surgeons were waiting next to do it. So we just went straight to the family room and sat in silence, like, what the,
must
just
have been
happened?
Such a surreal thing.
So still unreal.
Did you know he was going to do that with the organs? Because that's still an act of generosity, isn't it, at the end?
Well, I didn't. I hadn't. I'd thought about it, but I hadn't really. They didn't mention it when they said they were going to turn the vent. I just assumed they couldn't use anything. So it wasn't till we went back up, and then it was when they said, we've got a change in circumstances. I thought, what could that possibly be? So when it was that, I was relieved, and then I was praying that to find a match. I kept thinking, please, please find a match. So I was.
Which is so. Yeah, it's just.
Can't believe his heart is beating strongly, apparently, in somebody.
So altruistic, isn't it?
Yeah.
Bless you guys. So tough. You're taking all of this pain and experience and et cetera, to do really good work, right? It's, so, it's really humbling for me to sit here, because I think it's so, you know, everyone has life stories, and sometimes things are unbelievably painful and tragic, and yet you have the capability to rebring that to someone else's lives, right?
Yeah.
What if you could change something, Emily, for other people that have been in your position?
Yeah.
What is it you'd like to change?
That's a hard question. When I was younger, I guess I didn't really think that anyone else was going through the same sort of thing, so I didn't really realize it was like a kind of one in five thing. I thought it was kind of just like us and didn't really understand it all. But if I could change it, I would say that I would to know that other people have been in the same situation and are in the same situation, and that I actually have people to talk to and stuff.
Yeah. We do school talks to educate kids for Stride Foundation, and I know you guys work with the co-op.
Yeah.
How important is their work, do you think?
Very, definitely. Honestly, they help so many people, and just clicking on a website and talking to someone can help more than just not doing anything and just being on your own. But they help a lot. I don't know.
What was it that NACOA gave you guys that no one else did?
Support, I think.
Yeah, just support, to be honest.
To know that you're not alone with...
Yeah, no one else seemed to really understand that well, but they did. And, yeah.
So was it really like being listened to? Because they've got 30-odd years experience, haven't they, to talk to people?
Yeah, they've got a lot of experience, haven't they? And they can help, loads of people. And that helpline, I think, is amazing. And it's not just the children, but it's the children of alcoholics, but it's the older children, the adults of alcoholics.
Yeah.
Because they're still children of alcoholics. Yeah. So I think knowing they're there for life almost.
Because you still have the same path, don't you?
Yeah.
And what we're nearly to the end now, but what would you like to change, Lucy? Because I know we spoke before the podcast about, like, Amazon, it's easy to get alcohol delivered to the door. I've seen it with people getting Deliveroo, and I think that's horrendous. I think that should stop personally. Yeah. I think a really bad thing was when supermarkets put on discount alcohol everywhere, instead of back in the day when you had off licences.
Yeah.
What do you think should change?
Not having it in the aisles, not having it everywhere. Definitely needs to go in its own shops.
Yeah.
I think that was a lot of Emily's letter, was just trying to think about it so that they could help the children. And what Emily was saying roughly in the letter was that she wanted there to be more support for those children.
Yeah.
That are affected, and not just the addict themselves.
Yeah.
And to not have the alcohol in your face everywhere.
Mm.
And that it would feel better if it wasn't everywhere.
Which is brilliant to point out, because I think people take it for granted.
Yeah.
But it is everywhere, isn't it? You see it. And now again, we spoke about 00 alcohol, but it's still advertised.
Yeah.
I think the letter they wrote back was, when they said that they were going to help the addict themselves, but they haven't said about helping the family still.
Yeah.
And asking for that to be reinstated from...
Because the families take all the burden.
Yeah.
All the safeguard and all the energy, doesn't it?
So Emily's written back to them, which in the letter she's written to ask for more. She said, thank you for saying you'll help the addict, that's great, but... can you help?
She
said, I also asked you about alcohol advertising and if we can take stronger steps like other countries do, such as alcohol moving into its own aisle, reducing adverts, or at least not advertising during the daytime and when children will be watching. I hope this can be part of our conversation too. So she's written quite a lot back to them.
Yeah, good. Well done.
It'll be interesting to see.
Good morning, Britain. Sorry. The second I'd finished, the next advert was an alcohol advert. I'd just literally finished talking about it with everyone on Good Morning Britain.
And the
next advert
was
just an alcohol advert supporting it.
Makes no sense, does it?
Yeah.
Was that strange for you to go with Callum and the others to number 10?
Yeah, that was so weird. I didn't quite process it until after, and then I was like, I just went there.
Were they good? Was they good in there? Who did you meet?
Yeah. Who did we meet?
Rachel Reeves.
There was quite a lot of people to share. And then they had a cat called Larry.
Oh, yeah. Larry
was it
the cat,
Larry? Yeah. Got to give him a treat and streak.
Oh, did you?
Take a picture and everything. And then they just gave us a tour of the whole thing, basically.
Cool.
Loads of stories too, and they had all the pictures of all the other prime ministers on the walls and stuff going up the staircase. It was
Okay, yeah. Well, listen, I think it's been a real privilege for me to talk to you guys. Thank you so much for your bravery. And I think you're doing really good work. And I hope that, any support I can give as well, I hope that letter has impact. Because I'm sure it's like one in five people have this affected in the country, right? If everyone gets together, maybe we can make a big, big change. So thanks, everyone.
Thank you. Right.
Thanks for having us on.
This is Powerful is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com, where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also donate. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. Please rate, follow, and subscribe to the show. Why? This will help the algorithm make us more visible to others who need help. And share this podcast with your family, friends. Head over to social media at Paul Scholefoot and at this_is_powerful. You'll get to see what's coming up and you can get in touch with us because I love hearing about you. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica Amati, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Eberlong, who does all the hard work in the background, and the rest of the team.